He waited nearly a decade, 3,058 days to be precise, and you can see the emotion pouring out of Peter Malnati after winning the Valspar Championship over the weekend. Malnati speaking from the heart on what his second win on the PGA Tour means to him. You're going to want to hear this. Plus, we'll move from one bucket hat champ to another. 2022 Augusta National Women's Amateur Champion Anna Davis hops on the show. Anna, in the middle of her freshman season at Auburn, the 18-year-old joins us as she's once again in the field at Augusta next month. And how about the start of the season for Nelly Korda, capturing her second win on the LPGA Tour? It's not even April yet, doing something we haven't seen from an American golfer in more than a decade. We're going to break that all down and more as Golf Today starts right now.
Golf Today.
Hey there, happy Monday. Welcome inside our Golf Channel studios. I'm George Savarikas sitting alongside Matt Adams. We are here with you for the next hour, giving you everything we got. It's that time of year where, of course, a lot of people are focused on brackets, seeing if a blue blood's going to advance to the Final Four, or is it going to be a Cinderella upset story? It was fitting over the weekend on the PGA Tour that we had an underdog who ultimately was able to break through, Matt.
You know, I think an argument could strongly be made that this might be the best time of year for sport. Right? In our world of golf, we've got the Players, we've got the Masters right around the corner. In the world of sport, obviously everybody's brackets are already busted, but we've got Major League Baseball right around the corner. The NHL is heading towards the playoffs. The EPL is starting coming to a crescendo. And somehow, this week, through all of that, golf found its voice through the fray. And there we had Peter Malnati, who made a smile. We had Nelly Korda, who affirmed. And we had Padraig doing Padraig things. So in the world of golf and the world of sport, it was a good one.
I mean, that's what makes sports the best possible reality show.
Yeah.
Is moments like that down the stretch where you couldn't script to have Peter Malnati. I mean, he was, what, 300-1 or 350-1?
350, yeah.
Coming into the week. So a complete afterthought when you're thinking on Wednesday who's on the short list to win the Valspar Championship. Then he closes it out, and then you have that theater unfold on the 18th green, Matt. And for a Peter Malnati type, how was he able to get it done at Copperhead?
What's interesting to me is that his win is in and of itself a microcosm of what's going on in golf at a competitive level. If you look, it used to be the day where, you know, you drive for show and you putt for dough. And Peter is one of the great putters in the game of golf. But that ability has basically allowed him to keep his job for all these years, to keep his job. His driving stats, however, were not good. His average was 160th in strokes gained off the tee. He was 135th in driving distance. The week that was, get this, George, he was fourth off the tee. It just shows you it's that tiny little bit, but he was showing us signs of what he might be able to do. And the reason I say that is, look what he did at Pebble Beach. It ended up finishing tied for fourth. There. He took a little bit of stick for that because he got a sponsor's exemption into that event. If you remember the Cognizant Classic at Palm Beaches, tied for ninth, and then, of course, the victory with this past week. So, yes, he's finding something. The significance of those three top 15s that I just gave to you is that he had those three top 15s in his last five starts. His last time he had three top 15 finishes was in his last 30 starts. So, yes, this was a Peter Malnati that found something at Valspar, and certainly it came from what he did off the tee. There's a little doubt about that. But bigger picture for him is that he's found something this season. So perhaps there's some more good times coming.
When you look at Peter Malnati on the range, there isn't exactly jaw-dropping power by any means, or just like this natural athleticism that wows you, like a Cameron Champ type, who's won three times on the PGA Tour. With Malnati, he averages 290 off the tee. If you threw him in the field at a state am, you'd see other guys blowing three woods past his carry distance with a driver. And you talk with other pros on the PGA Tour or caddies, and the topic comes up, who's gotten the most out of their ability? Who's kind of maximized their game based on their body type and maybe any limitations? And Peter Malnati would often come up where it's like, this guy has been out here 10 years on the PGA Tour. He's now a two-time winner you look at his career, and he's missed more cuts than he's made cuts. Mm-hmm. And he's just one of those lifetime grinders that when he says there are thousands of Peter Malnati's out there, I think he means it, where people who look at him who say, if I can just get out there and keep chasing the dream on the PGA Tour, I could have that week or weeks where it comes together, and I'm the guy who's holding the trophy when it's all said and done.
What's interesting, too, with all of that, because the PGA Tour's own website described him as an everyman, right? But this is a Peter Malnati that, while he may well be at a competitive level, aptly described as an everyman, but he's also a policy board member. And so he has a different role now, a different visibility now. And like I said, he took some stick when he got the exemption. They said, is a policy board member getting the exemption? Then he goes out and he wins just a few weeks later to validate the position that he has and how he gets it done in his own unique way. And you have to wonder, he said he doesn't do social media and all that. He told us that last night after his victory. But you have to wonder if this win doesn't give him street cred from that standpoint with what he has to do. And one thing it exposed to everybody, because nobody really knew Peter that well in the years that went from win to this most recent win, is that he's an incredibly intelligent guy and a very deep thinker. And from my perspective, I think at least that bodes well if he's part of the conversations.
For Malnati, it was fascinating when he met with the media after the interview with Kira K. Dixon, and he spoke at length about what makes weeks like the Valspar Championship so important to the PGA Tour.
When my son Hatcher was born in 2019, I removed all my social media from my phone. So I don't do social media anymore, and I'm a happier person because of it. Not that it's bad, social media is not bad, but for me, I didn't use it particularly well because I would always read comments. I wanted to use it as a way to be interactive, but it wasn't healthy for me. So I removed it all. So I don't know specifically what is being said, about me, about the PGA Tour, about our sport in general, but I know the direction that it has been going for the last couple years. And when I was outside, I was compelled to say this. I feel like this win is, first and foremost, it's for me. It's for my family. It's for my caddy. It's for my team of people who support me. But on a larger scale, it's for Tampa. It's for the Copperheads. It's for Valspar. And it's for all the events on the PGA Tour who find themselves in this new ecosystem, kind of wondering where they fit and if they matter. I said this out there because I wanted the Copperheads and the people of Tampa and the people from Valspar to know that there are thousands of Peter Malnatis out there who are 10 years old right now, teenagers right now, who dream of playing golf on the PGA Tour. And they want to have the moment that I just got to have. And if we don't have, communities that believe in what the PGA Tour does, and sponsors who support what the PGA Tour does, we don't have those moments. I know that the narrative turns a lot to, we're coming up to Augusta, we're preparing for the majors, we're in that season. And there, in terms of the actual people who participate in golf at the highest level, 90% of us dream of the moment that I just had. There's a 10% that really do probably gear their schedules and focus on the majors, but 90% of the people who have made it to the top level of professional golf, and 100% of the people who dream of being at the top level of professional golf, live for that moment that I just had. And it's amazing. I'm proud of myself. I did a lot of hard work. I'm proud of my family. They supported me. But it doesn't matter, all that hard work and everything, we don't have tournaments to play in if we don't have communities that think these tournaments matter. And if we don't have host organizations like the Copperheads and, several other amazing host organizations around the country, we don't have a PGA Tour.
Let's continue the conversation with the Golf Today Roundtable as we welcome Golf Channel senior writers Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner. Rex, let's kick it off with you. We see the Malnati win over the weekend. Certainly a feel-good type of story. what makes these type of events so integral to the PGA Tour and their members.
I love listening to Peter last night because you could tell that's a guy who has sat through a lot of meetings as a player director on the policy board that had to do with exactly what he was referencing, the idea that he wanted to send the message that these events, the Valspar Championships, are important to the PGA Tour schedule. And this really boils down to the conversation over the last few weeks. I think Rory started the idea that wherever it is golf ends up next, the PGA Tour ends up next, it's going to look something close to maybe a World Tour where you have relegation and promotion. And you always sit and wonder, where are these events going to land? I'm talking about this week at the Valspar Championship, the Cognizant Classic a few weeks ago, the Sony Open. But if you look at so far this season, they've produced the full field events. They've produced some of the best stories so far. You had Grayson Murray winning. You had Nick Dunlap becoming the first amateur in decades to win on the PGA Tour. You had Peter Malnati last weekend. You had Jake Knapp. There's been so many really good stories to go along with Scottie Scheffler winning back-to-back weeks at Bay Hill, a signature event, and the Players' Championship. So I think whatever balance the tour has to strike, and again, Peter is in a really unique position to talk about this, it's important for the tour to understand and to cling to the idea that these communities that have been part of the tour for a long time remain part of the tour.
Ryan, when we talk about that from the standpoint of these communities that have been a part of the PGA Tour for a long time should remain, as Rex just aptly put it, we know that the push is on delivering the stars. I guess my question is, do the people, do the fans just want the stars? In what balance? Or is it about us being able to see the Peter Malnati stories? Are we sitting at home because somewhere we are cheering for the underdog? And isn't this the perfect time of year to talk about that?
Yeah, Maddie, I think it's a great point. And the more that I see these full field events, the more I'm convinced that they're essential to what the future of the PGA Tour needs to be. I almost wonder if like the PGA Tour was scarred from only having Tiger and Phil go head to head just a handful of times in the regular season PGA Tour schedule, because they're basically trying to create a shortcut path to get Scottie Scheffler to go against Rory McIlroy, whoever else you want to fill in the gaps, the stars versus the stars. But I think what's missing when you have that is any sort of depth or context to that achievement. Just think about the NCAA tournament and what transpired over the past 4 days. What the PGA Tour is essentially doing is lopping off that round of 64 and cutting it to either the round of 32 or maybe even the round of 16. Will that produce a better Final Four, a better champion? Probably. But right now, as we sit here on Monday, the heroes of the tournament to this point are teams like Oakland and Yale, which staged some of the upsets over the first couple of rounds. You know, some bit players or bit teams in this case, you know, they provide a lot of rooting interest for fans. But I think more than that, they provide a contrast to how great the greats actually are. And so without that, and if you create this kind of bloated live model where it's just the same 75 to 100 top players completing over and over again, it just, I fear that it's going to get stale, and I fear that it's going to get flavorless. And I think the Valspar Championship and the head-to-head duel that you had between Cameron Young and Peter Malnati was anything but stale and flavorless.
Yeah, and it was kind of the blessing and the curse of the WGCs to some extent over time. Speaking of the stars, we had some star power in the fold at the Valspar Championship. Justin Thomas, a big part of the conversation through two rounds, and then disaster struck on Saturday. Rex, the level of concern for what we saw with JT's game, and that was on the heels of missing two of his previous three cuts leading into the week at the Valspar.
I would say it's twofold, George. One, the ball striking seems to still be coming around. He still seems to be moving in the right direction. When you look at what he does tee to green, certainly the strokes gained statistics stand out as compared to last year. He does seem to be moving in a better direction. And I'm always really careful when we talk about these stats on the PGA Tour, because thanks to strokes gained, we can break them down really just down to the minute level and really dissect what a player's good at and what a player's not so good at. But I'm always careful to point out it's relative to the rest of the field. So you have 156 of the best players in the field last week at the Valspar Championship. And by comparison, his putting, at least on day three, was objectively awful. It was probably objectively awful even at an amateur event, because you look, he lost more than seven strokes to the field that day. I mean, if you just sat and watched the coverage, which I did, you were taken by the idea he never looked comfortable on the greens. And Ryan, Lav and I talked about this last night on the podcast. When you look at how we have dissected Scottie Scheffler over the last year, his putting stroke, everything he's done to get better, his work with his swing coach Randy Smith, his work with Phil Kenyon as a putting coach, his switch of putters every week, it seems like he is just grinding away on the range looking for answers. It seemed like he found some version of the answers at Bay Hill and then a week later at TPC Sawgrass. I'm not 100% sure because we don't hear about what JT is working on. And based on that performance last week, I will have a lot of alarm bells for no other reason than his next stop is probably going to be the Masters, and that's not a place you want to go looking for answers.
Speaking about looking for answers, Ryan,
Rex Esser,
go ahead.
I certainly feel differently just to Rex's point to button it up than I did a month ago. When you think about Riviera, you know, JT was gaining the most strokes on the field in his competitions over the past 6 months. I mean, in other words, he was playing better than anyone in the world, at least related to the players that he was playing against. He certainly regressed of late. The driver has cost in the last couple of events. Obviously, his putter continues to be a huge issue. But even in JT's best years, I mean, he was an average putter to slightly above average putter. And in fact, in some years, he was losing strokes to the game while still winning multiple times on the PGA Tour. There has to be a way to neutralize that. Because I think the Players' Championship a couple weeks ago was the perfect example of that, where I don't think once Wyndham Clark and Brian Harman and Xander Schauffele were sitting around and thinking, what could I have done differently? There were not major things that they could have done differently to end up beating Scottie Scheffler. I mean, the margins are so small now and so thin at that elite level that JT has to find a way to sort of neutralize his putting deficiency at the moment if he wants to once again join the elite tier in golf.
Guys, we're only halfway through the conversation. Coming up, we're going to touch on if golf needs a truly dominant player in the game as our golf table roundtable returns. It's on the other side of the short break.
Welcome back as we continue our conversation with Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner. So, Ryan, the question I wanted to ask you in the last segment was coming off our discussion about JT was about Jordan Spieth. Here we have Jordan Spieth, misses the cut at the Players, misses the cut at the Valspar. Prior to that, tied for 30th at the API and disqualified at the Genesis. His overall stats look Jordan-esque, are okay, save for strokes gain approach, where he's not even close to average, an area where he used to be amongst the leaders on tour. How concerned are you with Jordan Spieth as we head towards the first major in the men's side of the game?
Yeah, Maddie, I don't think we have a great gauge on where Jordan Spieth's current game is right now. Like, the year started actually pretty auspiciously at Kapalua. I think it was reasonable to assume that Jordan Spieth might be turning a corner and he might get back to kind of his major winning ways. But in his words that he had last week at Innsbruck, he said it's been a really weird year. You know, he cracked a driver, he had the flu, he had the DQ at Riv when he was also sick, and you know, he's been distracted with some of the PGA Tour policy board matters that have been going on. And he has not been better, Jordan Spieth has not, over the past 6 years, than 26th in strokes gained total. In other words, he has been good but not great. And I think that kind of epitomizes exactly what he's been over the past 6 years, which is good but not great. That's the reason why he has just two wins since 2017. So I think Jordan Spieth remains a compelling figure. But to your point, the results and the stats aren't really matching up with who Jordan Spieth is and his kind of a name recognition.
Yeah, who was, you could say, a dominant player in 2015 when he had five wins and two majors and was the FedEx Cup champion. Justin Thomas was asked, does the game of golf, is it better when there is a dominant player in the game?
Is golf better off with a dominant player? I was going to leave Tiger out again, but with a dominant player, or is it better with this group that's probably grown by the year?
It's a really good question. I've thought about it before too, and I it's probably not fair to say, but I think it legitimately depends who it is. I know that's harsh, but it's like, you know, anybody's going to watch again, you shouldn't compare or use Tiger, but anybody's going to watch Rory or a lot of, you know, someone like him or Jordan, whatever, like win by 7 or 8, just because you still don't know the fun. And, you know, Jordan might be leading by 6, but he's still going to have that hilarious conversation with Greller and the trees on 16 of how he feels like he can, you know, slice this 3-wood onto the green when it's not really going to gain him anything. And maybe he pulls it off and maybe he doesn't, or chips it. You know, there's the excitement factor versus, you know, others. And I think it's better for the game. I know it's motivating for me when it's like this, because I feel like there's a lot of guys that I'm jealous of, to be honest, of how well they're playing and all the things they do well in their game, to where that pushes me to want to kind of do the same. So I guess it just kind of depends on who you ask.
Rex, let's start with you. Does the men's side need a dominant player in the game?
I agree with JT, and actually I celebrate that refreshing honesty of his, because of course it matters who that number one is, whether they're dominant or not. And I think our friend Doug Ferguson probably did himself a favor trying to keep Tiger out of it, because that's always an unfair comparison. But when you look at Tiger Woods' reign as world number one, not only was he dominant, not only did he deliver on all that promise that he showed early in his career, but he also sort of crossed all the way over across every sport, even to celebrity. So that was pretty easy. Everyone is going to gravitate towards that. I love what he said about Jordan Spieth. I actually said this to Lab last night when we were doing the podcast. Watching Jordan Spieth on Friday at the Valspar Championship, I know we don't have our version of the Manning cast, but I would love to see our version of the Jordan cast, because he is very entertaining, whether if he's shooting 76 or 66. And I think that's another one of those things that you would gravitate towards as a world number one. However, that said, I find Scottie Scheffler, our current world number one, to be very entertaining, just because of the way he plays the game and how dominant he can be. You look at what he did at Bay Hill. You look at what he did at the Players' Championship, clearly without his best game. So, of course, it matters. But I think right now, the stars that you sort of have in that universe, they can all sub in and out and be equally entertaining.
So, Rye, you just heard Rex say that he finds Scottie Scheffler entertaining. That is something different than saying that he finds him dominating. Is it too soon? I guess the first question I have for you is, how do you define a dominating player? But is it too soon to place that crown upon Scottie Scheffler?
I mean, based on the play that he's had over the past 2 or 3 years, he's been consistently excellent. It's hard to say that he's been dominated. I mean, just before Bay Hill, like, I had a piece penned where Scottie Scheffler was reflecting on what was a 51-week winless drought on the PGA Tour. I know he won the Hero, but on the PGA Tour, at least, it had been almost a year since he had won on the PGA Tour. So he's not dominant in that sense. I think it's such an interesting conversation, Maddie, because I think Justin Thomas is absolutely right, that it does depend on who the player is. That feels like a cop-out, but I think it's the most accurate statement. Like, people were attracted to Tiger because it felt like you were watching something historic. People were attracted to Jordan because it's kind of this never-ending thrill ride. People are attracted to Rory because of his charisma and his controversy, which seems to come in equal measure. I think Scottie's appeal, you know, within the sports world is so different. In person, I think it's an entirely different experience than what you're getting on TV. In person, I think he's an absolute treat to watch. Like, the shot-making ability is absolutely off the charts. And yeah, I don't know if that necessarily translates to the television product, because he's also very humble. He's understated. He's gracious. He's grounded. And I think that's a bit of a hard sell. But there's sort of like a competitive elegance to Scottie Scheffler as well. And Roger Federer was that exact way. Roger Federer was dominating on the tennis court while also being hugely marketable and immensely popular among the fans. That seems to be the route that Scottie is going, as opposed to kind of the traditional dominance that we think of in golf, whether it was Jack or Tiger.
Yeah, guys, a parting shot. The answer, yes, but it needs to be for a long interval of time. Rory did it from 2011 to 14. Jordan had a 3-year run, 15 to 17. JT had a 3-year run. There's just such a shorter window compared to Tiger, that was 15-plus years, Jack, 2-plus decades. But people want to see the Yankees, the Lakers, the Celtics. Like, they want to see a team or a player that can win majors over a long period of time, so you can either root for or against whoever they perceive as dominant. Rex and Lav, thanks so much for joining us.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Cruising right along on golf today. Invitations to compete in the 2024 Augusta National Women's Amateur were sent back in January. Full field of 72 players have been confirmed for the championship, which will be held April 3rd through 6th in Augusta.
2022 champion Anna Davis will be making her third appearance in the event. Her final round 69 at Augusta National 2 years ago included birdies at number 2, 9, 12, and 13. It was enough for a one-stroke victory over Ingrid Lindblad and Latana Stone. Davis is now a freshman at Auburn University and a member of the women's golf team. She has two top 25 finishes this season, including a tie for 8th in the Darius Rucker Intercollegiate earlier this month. Delighted to tell you that Anna Davis joins us right now. Anna, thank you for taking the time to join us. After you won the Augusta National Women's Amateur, how much did it change your life?
In so many ways. Traveling across the world, playing a bunch of LPGA events, meeting new people, having new experiences at just the age of 16 was very life-changing. You know, not very many people get to play on the LPGA Tour and play in a ton of majors at just 16 years old. And so I'm still very thankful for the opportunities, and I think it's shaped me into the person I am today.
And how has that person evolved, where you've gone from incognito before, say, the spring of 2022 to where you are now in your freshman year at Auburn?
Just lots of exposure to the media, obviously, just getting to meet a lot of people, a lot of important people. But I think I've just changed a lot in the way I socialize and the way I interact with people. You know, not very many 17, 18-year-old girls get to have some of the experiences that I've had. And so very grateful for that. And I think just having all these experiences has also kind of led me to grow up a little faster than your average teenager. And obviously coming in to Auburn a semester early as well. And just having all of these different experiences growing up pretty fast. I live on my own now. So just things like that have really shaped the way that I act and the way that I am now.
Anna, these experiences, as you phrase it, this exposure, to use another phrase that you used, I'm curious about how you handled the weight. How did you handle the weight of expectation that had gone with what you'd accomplished?
I think at first, for me, it was pretty difficult. You know, obviously being 16, which is still pretty young, and having that be the first time that I was really in the public eye, I guess, and being seen as a top amateur in golf. And I think at first it was hard for me to handle the pressure and the expectations, and, you know, having to go out to a tournament and now having people think, okay, well, she has to win this or she has to do this. I think at first was pretty tough, but feel like I changed my perspective a little bit and just going out and trying my best and enjoying myself and not really worrying what people think. I know people that are watching want me to do well, and so I think just not having the expectations really get to me, because it just doesn't really matter.
Anna, you won the Augusta National Women's Amateur at 16. You made your LPGA Tour debut that year. A year later, your twin brother Billy Monday qualifies into his first event on the PGA Tour, and then you both land at Auburn as a package deal on the men's and women's team. Mm-hmm. How important was it to share that journey together and ultimately go to the same spot where you are in college?
I think we both recognize that it's a real advantage that we've grown up playing together and competing against each other and just being able to feed off each other. And when we have an issue, having that other person there. So I think both of us recognized it would kind of be hard for us to go to college without each other. And it kind of just happened that we were going to go to Auburn together. And I'm very excited for him to come in the fall. And but I think just seeing him do well, and I think him seeing me do well, it kind of, you know, feeds us, and it makes us want to do better. And we always want the other to do really well. So,
Anna, when you famously won the Augusta National Women's Amateur wearing the bucket hat, did you instantly become the golfer wearing the bucket hat? Was that something that was normal for you, or was it all of a sudden something that was associated with you? You're like, how?
Well, that day, I kind of just put on a bucket hat because I saw it was going to be a sunny day, and I thought, oh, what a perfect day for a bucket hat. But I had never really worn it a lot. So I kind of fed into the bucket hat thing for a while, but I've stopped now. I haven't worn it in a while, actually. So,
any chance that you could? I mean, we're what, a few weeks away now from the Augusta National mm-hmm. Women's Amateur. Yeah. Any chance you'd dust it off for that final round at Augusta?
I might pull it out. We'll see. Just to make the people happy.
And finally, just your expectations. You're getting ready now for your third appearance at the Augusta mm-hmm. National Women's Amateur. Mm-hmm. So you've returned once as defending champion. Now this will be the third time you tee it up in this mm-hmm. event.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, very excited to go back. Just playing there, any opportunity you get is a blessing. And so just going to go into the week and enjoy myself. Obviously, had a rough year last year, so... just trying to, you know, get over that and keep in mind, yeah, I did win the first year and, you know, I've played well on both of these golf courses. And so I think it's just important for me to go out and just enjoy myself and have a good time and, you know, play some good golf.
Well, Anna, we will certainly be watching. Best of luck as you prepare
Thank
now
you.
For your third journey to the Augusta National Women's Amateur and for the rest of the season at Auburn.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.